Many don't believe that either the trumpets with melodious noise or the infernal din await us where the road ends. But most, I fancy, have discovered that to be born is to be exposed to delights and miseries greater than imagination could have anticipated. That the choice of ways at any crossroads may be more important than we think, and that shortcuts may lead to very nasty places.
And we are back. This is the Pilgrims Podcast, and it is our 42nd episode, and probably our last before I end up heading off to school. So, we're going to hold off on the comments from last week for now, because this week we've actually got, for the first time ever, a guest. So, that ought to be fun. Today we're going to be having Scott Ott on the program, who writes for scrappleface.com. and is a co-host for Right Angle and hosts news actually at BillWhittle.com. Is that correct?
Sounds close enough to me.
Yeah. Okay. Welcome on the program, sir.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me on.
Well, before we get much further, I wanted to kind of give a little bit of background on kind of where we ran into you. We are both longtime Trifecta fans. It was probably, I don't know, election of 2008, maybe. I know I was like 12 or 13.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes, I know. So
we have Trifecta babies.
Yeah, but Dad was, I know that we'd both been listening to PJTV because that was the point at which I decided to become political. I was a little terror. But
you say that with the past tense.
Oh, yeah, well, I hope that I have grown somewhat out of that phase anyway. We started listening to Trifecta in fairly early days, and it's become probably our favorite political show ever since. So that's,
And Right Angle, of course, now. But it's hard to overstate the impact that you guys have had on our political thought. I mean, granted, sometimes I guess we'd come to kind of reinforce ideas or concepts that we already kind of held on to, but it was interesting to see, the different approaches that you three guys would take to these various topics, many of which, by the way, that I was, that weren't exactly in the mainstream media, and so that were news to us, okay? So we were always wanting to check out what the boys over at Trifecta were up to.
Well, that's very encouraging. I appreciate you saying that. We have done it for, we've been together, Steve Green, Bill Whittle, and I, for about 8 years or so. And we rarely see each other in person. I think we've only met like three times. But the show really clicked from early on. And we loved it so much that when its former production company shut down their video arm, we just said, hey, let's keep doing the show. And so we created Right Angle at BillWhittle.com.
I'm so glad you did. We are members there and keeping up.
Thank you.
I encourage any of our listeners to, by all means, check out BillWhittle.com and join up.
Yeah. Before we go to, leave the topic, I was just going to say, I love how Trifecta is kind of a perfect cross-section of conservatism. You have three differing views from a different philosophical viewpoints that I think, you have like sort of more libertarian viewpoint, a more evangelical viewpoint, and then Bill Whittle, which I think is like the conservative plus Lord of the Rings plus Virtue and Honor and
Star Trek.
A variety of those different things. It's interesting because whenever you guys do a topic, you can kind of hear a little bit, I think, from each group, or at least from each angle, So that's always been kind of fascinating to me. And we can usually predict which way you guys will fall on each issue, usually. That's entertaining. But anyway.
For me, it's exciting to be able to have a civil discussion among people who, while on the larger questions we may have basic agreement, we often disagree on aspects of things, tactics, methods, ways to approach things.
Right.
And certainly some of our worldview issues vary just based on how we see things. But it's never been uncivil. And absolutely, it's always been fun. And it, to me, it's just part of a lifelong quest in politics anyway, to prove not that you have to compromise and so that you can get along with everybody, but that you can get along with everybody and still be able to clearly state your views and be responsive to other people's and to interact with that without being confrontational, without being hateful.
Yeah, it's definitely a model that we need, especially after this last year. When civility, you know, what is civility anymore? Yeah. I've never seen this thing. And it's something which I have definitely found useful going into the liberal arts classrooms that I've been in.
Good luck with that.
But I
will pass along your encouraging words to Bill and Steve. They'll love to hear this.
Oh, well, thank you. I still remember being like 14 or so and getting one of my questions on a Stratosphere Lounge, and I was tickled to death.
I'm still looking forward to that day. I'm 55, yeah. And he hasn't answered any of my questions yet.
Oh, well, I made it. That was back on, it was the second episode, because I remember. I've looked it up on YouTube a few times since then.
Wow.
Anyway, to kind of get into our topics today, I guess we can't avoid talking about the presidential election, but kind of one of the
we
more...
We can if you'll let me.
Well, I'm afraid not. But these questions might be a little bit dated because I wrote them like a month ago and we've had issues kind of connecting. But anyway, kind of one of the most concerning things for me about this election is just how seemingly rock-ribbed conservatives have sold their souls to a man who cares nothing for the Constitution. And, you know, I don't mean guys, people who are voting for him just because they hate Hillary. And,
but we know. Do know where he can get a copy of the Constitution.
We do, that. Yeah. I mean, it's just, and it's not people who, you know, admit that they have reservations, but people who just throw all that out and toe the party line just completely, that was something which I was more, which I usually saw among liberals. So that was just, it's kind of concerning. And not only now is disdain for constitutionalism considered kind of attractive among liberals, but among conservatives, they're abandoning this framework of constitutional liberty. So for both approaching liberals I don't mean necessarily everybody in this category is in the alt-right, but that's, I guess, a good term for the alt-right and the liberals. How do we make constitutionalism attractive again? How do we free it from its reputation as kind of part of the musty, old-fashioned establishment? And
Well, I'm not sure that it's ever been seen as unattractive as it has been sort of a pie-in-the-sky thing. Well, you know, gee, that's nice, Hannah, that you have these dreams of a constitutional republic.
Yeah.
But that's not how things work in the real world. And so, you know, you just need to get your feet back on the ground and get your head out of the clouds and, you know, remember that the worst thing that could possibly ever happen to this republic in its 240-year history would be the election of this woman from New York. I mean, Arkansas. I mean, wherever she's from. So, you know, that mentality, it's funny because my case has been all along with the Donald Trump candidacy. While everybody was talking about what an outsider he is, I have just enough political experience running for local office and my engagement with, you know, for years now of writing and talking about this stuff, to realize that actually he's the establishment's dream. He's the perfect candidate for the Republican establishment because nothing really matters to him but winning. And so that was my complaint about Republicans all along. That's why I got involved in politics back in 2009, because it was frustrating me that we had all these people who were going around bearing the banner of my party's name, but it didn't seem that my party's principles mattered a whit to them. And so, you know, now we've got the guy who's like the ultimate Republican establishment guy, and the establishment people are all pretending that, oh, we don't really care for him, but it's just because he's gauche. It's not because it's not because of anything having to do with his principles, his values, or his beliefs.
Yeah, I don't know if you recall, but I think Jimmy Carter even kind of tongue-in-cheek endorsed him, saying that this is a guy that we could mold, you know?
Oh, yeah. Well, and see, the funny thing is, behind the scenes, the GOP guys are saying the same thing. They're saying, oh, don't worry about this, you true red-blooded conservative constitutionalist. Don't worry about him, because he'll do what we say when he gets in office because he's such a knucklehead, he won't know what to do, and he'll have to take his marching orders from us. To which I respond, well, he hasn't done what you say so far. I mean, he's still ignoring your best advice. He's still shooting his mouth off, and saying things that any sensible candidate would never say. So what makes you think he's suddenly going to change? And they go, oh, well, you've got to have him in there because he's going to pick Supreme Court justices that are constitutionalists. I'm like, really? My experience with Donald Trump and his history has been that he will do whatever it takes in the moment to achieve his objective. When he needed to swing some constitutional conservatives over to his side during the primary process, then he released the list that came from, National Review and the Federalist people of the potential Supreme Court jurists. But who's he going to need when he gets in office? He's not going to need them anymore. He's going to need Harry Reid and his buddies. And so then that list will expand, and he'll have some nominees on there that we'll be shaking our heads about and saying, gee, I don't know if we would have been worse off with Mrs. Clinton.
Yeah, and let's just hope that he doesn't keep thinking that he needs to pander to the Nazis.
Well, I'll leave that in your mouth, not mine.
Anyway, so it's a crazy election. But and before we move on from that, I want to say that I think it was a right angle ending, talking about the using an analogy of a ship leaning one way and the other. That was one of my favorites from recently, talking about Trump. So that was really brilliant. I'll put a link to it.
Frankly, when I'm saying this, I don't think Donald Trump would actually be offended by it. That he basically does what it takes to get the deal done.
Agreed.
This is his modus operandi. There's nothing wrong with it because that's what you do in business. Not every business person is like this, but a lot of times you have to do things where you say, you know what, that's not my druthers, but I got to do it because we need to close this deal. And so he's a transactional ethicist. He's not somebody who gets bogged down in principles that won't matter anyway, because if you lose the election, then who cares whether you are Ted Cruz's, you've got Ted Cruz's values. It doesn't matter if you can't win.
Yeah. I think that was highlighted when he had the gaffe about, whether or not women should be thrown in jail for abortions. He thought that's what
we wanted to hear.
We wanted to hear. Right. It was just like, no.
It's like, I mean, the guy knows no pro-life people, but he's like, okay, this is what?
Yes. It must be what they want.
Yeah, well, it's like, he's been shaped by liberalism, he's got all the stereotypes about the people that he thinks that he's supposed to pander to.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's like living inside the onion.
I have a question for you, though, Scott, and this has got to do with kind of the evangelical world, as it revolves around Trump, which we all revolve around Trump.
In his mind, everything orbits him, yes.
Or at least the hair. I've seen evangelicals, some of which, that I respect and admire, that have lined up behind Mr. Trump. And
sure.
And obviously some that haven't. Russell Moore comes to mind immediately, but
he's still a holdout. Good to hear.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, he's at the forefront of the movement.
And there just seems to be a kind of this civil war that's going on. It's really, how do we kind of pick our way through this minefield and still come out the other side being brothers and sisters?
Well, and that's a big challenge, and I think that, because I can't control other people's behavior, I just have to control my own. And so even though I have strong opinions on the matter, if somebody says to me, gives me the reason why they're voting for Donald Trump, for example, or for Hillary Clinton, for that matter,
right.
I'm going to treat that person as if they're not an idiot, as if they're not evil, as if they put some thought into what they're doing and they disagree with me. And, as an old relative of mine used to say, that's why they make chocolate and vanilla. I mean, different people are going to see things different ways. I think the thing we have to sort of back off from a little bit even in the conservative movement, if you want to call it that, and I'm reluctant to even use that term anymore because people, you know, might ask me, what in the world are you trying to conserve? I mean, what's left? But anyway, I think sometimes we need to back off our catastrophism and acting like every election is going to be the end of the world if it doesn't come out the way we like it to. Certainly the Obama administration has been a stain on the republic, but it's not been the worst possible outcome. It's not been the worst thing they've got. We survived it, and we will get through the next 6 or 8 months. And if Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump should have four years or 8 years, we're going to survive that too, because ultimately, especially if you come at it from my perspective of, you know, these wacky Jesus lovers like me, ultimately the world is in the hands of a sovereign authority who does not have to stand for election every 4 years.
Grand.
Yeah, I think that's just kind of, I think it's an important observation that a lot of the people that do think, evangelicals that do think it's rather the end of the world, tend to do so because they think the end of America might be the end of the world, or that bad things that happen in America, you know, are, you know, the end of the world. It's just very much centered on the status of this one country, which I think is probably unhelpful and, you know, a little bit on the, well, just not a great attitude, and possibly one lacking in some perspective.
And if you're out in the real world, you know, doing a job, as I've been forced to do lately, you know, when you talk to most people are not honed in on this the way we are. Most people do not, you know, eat, sleep, and drink politics.
Yeah.
And they just want to, I mean, they've got stuff going on. They want to be able to make the next mortgage payment. They want their kid to get into a decent school. They want to, you know, they're hoping that their marriage can hold together for the rest of the year. And, you know, they've got lives to live and problems that are so far beyond this little tit-for-tat geek spat that's happening on TV that it's hard for them to get as lathered up about it. And they look at us and just say, what difference does it make? Vote for one, vote for the other. One way or the other, I still got to pay my mortgage at the end of the month.
Right. I think that's exactly right. But it has been, I mean, you know, some of those rifts between evangelicals are pretty deep. I mean, I've taken a few hits, not that I'm a, you know, I mean, I just basically made it clear that I wasn't in the guy's corner, and it's not set well with several people.
Now, is that happening to you, like, in the local body of Christ at church, or is it happening online?
Online.
Yeah. See, my theory there is we're a nation of cowards when we get online, because, you know, we say things online that we would never think to say face to face with someone, because you have to make eye contact with somebody. You're within arm's reach and possibly a swing, and you're not gonna talk like that. I mean, people just don't do that, except if they're in stage situations like being online or showing up for one of these rallies or protests.
Yes.
Outside of a rally or whatever. So, and I think that's part of the, what Christians can do, for example, is to bring a little humility to the subject and acknowledge, you know, I've made my stand, and I've said that if Donald Trump were to have a complete repentance and turn around and head the other direction, then I could consider voting for him. But as things stand now, for a large number of reasons I've enumerated in previous broadcasts, I can't support him. That said, I love people who are supporting him. I can be gracious to them. I don't have to mistreat them. And if you can reflect that even in your online persona, so to speak, and say, you know, look, this guy's really hopped up about Trump. There's no turning him. I'm not going to try to beat him over the head with that. A man convinced against his will is of the same opinion still. So it's not going to really do anything for me to get all lathered up. So, you know, I stop reading my Twitter stream when these people get all fired up about it, because I'd much rather be an ambassador for Christ than to be an advocate for some political viewpoint.
Well, I tend to agree with you on that. And I guess, you know, to kind of segue into our next topic, which is connected. It has to do, I guess, with just how this entire election is focused somewhat on the differences between you know, the need to be principled and the need to compromise and all of those things. And, you know, after the recent tragedy in Orlando, President Obama argued against branding it Islamic terrorism because words have no meaning, and he was kind of holding forth about this. And, you know, and on the other side, you have Trump's promises. I mean, they're not worth the paper they're written on. And there's one of my favorite and one of the most absurd exchanges in the election. Dan Senor and I think, was it Barry Bennett? I know it was one of the, I think Trump's senior advisors. They were on the TV, and Senor said, typically words matter. He was kind of going after the guy saying, you know, Trump needs to be held to what he's saying. He said, typically words matter when political leaders, and Bennett interrupted him. He said, oh, please, this words matter stuff. I mean, this is ridiculous. I mean, you were looking desperately for a reason not to vote for him. I don't care. Don't vote for him. And it just, you know, I mean, it's hard to get more perfect than that. Just this, I mean, if words and therefore oaths, promises have no meaning, then what is there to constrain our leaders?
Well, and Trump, in many ways, I mean, he is the triumph. I was going to say the triumph of nationalism or populism, but really it's the triumph of victoryism. It is the triumph of winning at any cost. And so if I were on that side of the fence, I think you could make a good case to say, look, Ted Cruz, God bless him, that knucklehead. I mean, he can cling to his charming, antiquated concepts having to do with separation of powers and enumerated powers and checks and balances. That's all very clever. But the reality is, he's in Texas or he's in D.C. now, back at work, because he can't win with that message. And so the American people have spoken, or at least those who voted in Republican primaries, both Republicans, Democrats, and independents, all three, they've spoken. This is what the American people want. And so who are you to deny them because you pointy-headed academics want to tell us, you know, what was in Federalist Number 71?
Well, at least happily, there are probably a few more people that know what is in the Federalist Papers, thanks to a certain musical.
That's right. Yeah. See, that's how you connect. Not with, you know, Ted Brillcream Cruz going around with, you know, trying to. Yeah, I love him. He's a nice guy. But he didn't have the imagery and the ability to connect with people the way a musical does. And so,
yeah, and that's, I would have loved, you know, and I'm disappointed in him these days, but Rubio, I think he had a much greater ability to connect through pop culture, which, especially my generation, that's, you know, all we care about. It's yet another chance for me to do a Hamilton plug. So it's terrific. I I read an entire biography of Alexander Hamilton because of the musical. I just finished it last week. So
I'm so ill at ease in today's culture that I actually read the biography before I even knew there was a musical. So it's kind of awkward. I know, but I confess it.
That is at least, you know, we were talking about making constitutionalism attractive again, you know.
Yeah.
there's a way.
And I think the way, you know, and I probably dodged the question, but I think the way you connect with people about that, obviously you can do that through the culture, through music, through drama, through art and things like that. But ultimately, the test of constitutionalism comes down to the question that every person asks in their heart unconsciously, which is WIFM, what's in it for me? What's in it for me? What difference does it make to my life? And I think we've probably done a poor job in selling the idea of individual liberty, in selling the idea of a government that's restrained from invading our privacy, despite the fact that, you know, now more, as you know, as the commercial would say, now more than ever, you know, you've now more than ever, we've had, what have we seen, you know, with the IRS and the NSA and, you know, all of these invasions of our privacy, all of this stuff going on. And somehow constitutionalists have been unable to stand up and say, you know what? There is a way to do things. I'm not going to talk to you about 240 years ago. What I want to tell you is there is a way to do things in which your private thoughts and your private papers and the inside of your home are yours. They belong to you, and they're not open to government scrutiny unless you violate the law in some way that requires us to try to protect others from you. You know, we have a message that says we're the happiness people. We are the pursuit of happiness people. That's the whole reason why this thing was founded, was on the idea of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And yet somehow some of the most dour people I've ever met are people who agree with me philosophically. And I'm like, how did you get this way? And so I use this little tagline on a lot of different things that I do, including almost every email that I sent, which says, live the freedom. This is how you persuade your neighbors, is when they see the joy in you that comes from experiencing liberty. Not just, you know, as a theological precept, but as something that you live day to day. What have you done with your liberty? How are you using that? Are you really pursuing your dreams and your calling and your purpose in life? Or are you just sitting back and engaging in political, you know, try to think of a nice way to say this, contests? You know, why aren't we the happiest people on earth? Because we know that liberty is at the soul of everything that makes society good. It makes people live longer. It makes people have better health. It makes people have more prosperity. It makes children happier. It makes wives, you know, it's the first society in the world where we're, you know, the big concern every single day is not that every one of our neighbors is probably beating his wife. You know, it's more of a phenomenon here when that happens rather than a cultural imperative as it's happening in other countries. We've got the greatest system ever created by humans, and in many ways you could say it was divinely inspired, and somehow we can't sell this. You know, it's like, I'm in Texas, it's 101 degrees today. It's like, I think I could sell a snow cone on the street. You know, why can't we sell liberty?
Yeah, and that's, I think, where, you know, stories are so important, is that, you know, conservatives have no idea about how to tell a story, you know, because that's where you take what's abstract and you turn it into a concrete thing. It's, you know, I mean, literally God himself had to write himself into our story for us to be able to figure him out, to identify with him. He had to look like us. He had to, you know, condescend to our level, and stories have a way of doing that, of, you know, of taking these huge concepts and then turning them into, oh, okay, this is, you know, and liberals are great at that.
Well, and even if we could do that with our neighbors, like do the same thing, essentially become liberty incarnate for these people. I was on a plane flight once from Allentown, Pennsylvania, down to Philadelphia, and it's just a little puddle jumper, so I think they're in the air for like 15 minutes or something like that. Anyway, I was sitting next to this guy, and he and I were both pretty big guys, but he bigger than me, and it was this large black man, and we got to talking, and it turns out that his job is being a truck driver. And somehow I think I was reading something, then he asked me if I was into politics or something. And we were talking for a while, and he says he really didn't know what he was politically, but I'm sure he was voting Democratic. And I said, you work on a truck, right? You drive a truck? And he said, yeah. And I said, were you ever unloading the truck? And there's another guy who's supposed to be helping you, but he really isn't. He's kind of goofing off, smoking a cigarette, you know, hanging out on the dock, and you're doing all the work. And he goes, yeah. He said, that actually happens a lot. And I said, how do you feel about the fact that that guy gets paid the same as you do, even though you did all the work? And he goes, that's awful. He's like, that's really terrible. And so all I was doing was kind of telling him a story from his own life that he could connect with. And the more he engaged with that story, as we were getting near the end of the flight, I said, you know, from everything you've said to me, you've given every indication to me that you're a Republican. And he kind of looked at me funny. And as we parted in the airport, we got out off the jetway and we shook hands, and I said goodbye to him. And he looked at me and he said, so I'm a Republican, huh? And I was like, I just smiled, you know? But see, we don't take the time to not only to tell our story, which, you know, tends to be a PowerPoint presentation with, you know, three vague points that happened 200 years ago. Instead, connect with somebody and say, hey, what do you do for a living?
Yeah.
You know, do we really want to connect with people and say, oh, tell me about your children? You know, do you want your children to have options into what career they choose, or do you prefer a system where the government decides? You know, how do you like it when you earn a bunch of money and you have to hand it over to somebody else and you don't even know what they're doing with it? You know, and just connect with where they are instead of trying to make them see things the way we are. I think we forget our own journey. You know, I was a liberal in college. I think we forget how long it took us to come up with all these ideas and to believe them.
Yeah, I mean, it's very biblical, I think, as well. I mean, it kind of ties into that, is, you know, why is the world struggling so much with, you know, kind of wallowing in the mud when you've got a holiday at the beach, right?
Yeah. I mean, really, the good life awaits the one who will believe in Jesus Christ, in a sense.
Right.
Now that good life may result in your, you know, execution and persecution and all that kind of stuff. But
there's another way.
But it's still good.
Yes, yes. And I think in the old days, the 1970s, there was this movement to share the gospel with people by going, Jesus loves you and has a wonderful plan for your life. And I'm glad I wasn't like a believer at that point in my life, because I would go like, Jesus loves you and has a wonderful plan for your life, which may involve you getting your head chopped off. But
yeah, I remember going through that phase.
Yeah.
It's like, you people don't realize how gritty this is going to be, and it's a tough road.
Well, yeah, and it's funny, because Jesus, when he saw the people were following him just because they were wowed by what he did and they thought they might get something from him, he started saying what we would consider to be crazy things. You know, you've got to eat my flesh and drink my blood. You've got to take up a cross and follow me. You know, your own relatives are going to hate you if you're not willing to put me in front of everything else in the world. And people were like, oh my goodness, this guy's whacked. You know, he's unhinged.
Yeah. One of my favorite songs is called God's Own Fool by Michael Card. And it's he kind of talks about that concept of how Jesus, people must have thought he was absolutely insane.
Oh, yeah.
And he was just, you know, this complete social outcast. He walks in and, you know, turns over all the tables and,
paradox.
Yeah, you know, says all these nutty things. But anyway, we have kept you for over 30 minutes now, you know. We've run out of time.
And at my contract rate, too. Man.
Yeah.
But it has been an absolute pleasure. Dad, he did want to say right before we cut off that you need to read Tales of Two Cities.
Yeah, absolutely. You got to finish that.
Because it is one of our favorites. It's terrific.
And I know.
Tales of Two Cities. I think I started reading that. And is that the one with the Lafarge people? Is that are they in there?
Yeah, Dave Farge, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and the first three quarters of it, two thirds of it, you're gonna just, you know, you think it's not going anywhere, but the last third of it is just makes it work. So I'd encourage you.
You know, I'm not a young man anymore. I've got to sort of plan how much time I can spend on any given activity, because the clock.
Well, you like.
I'm right there with you, brother.
Clock is ticking down, man.
You like Les Mis, right?
Oh my goodness, yes.
Okay, well this is like Les Mis, but without the kind of creepy pro-French Revolution stuff.
At the end of Les Mis, I was going to join the French Revolution. Okay, I wasn't sitting in the balcony, I would have been on the stage. It was a good thing I was restrained.
Yeah, we went to see a version of that a few years ago, and it's terrific. But I will say, A Tale of Two Cities, the book is actually, I would definitely say it's better than Les Mis, the book.
Okay.
Les Mis is a brick. They call it the brick, actually. It's over like 1,000 pages long.
Yeah, I started to try to read that in French, and then I decided that my French wasn't that good and I would never live long enough to finish it.
Yeah. I actually, funnily enough, I finished it in 16 days. I don't know what I was doing that week, but I don't think it must have been anything.
So anyway, I hope you can hope you would consider doing that. But it is a terrific book.
I appreciate the recommendation and will make no commitments.
Okay. All right, Scott, we do appreciate your time very much.
Thank you.
And really, again, just want to encourage you and your brothers there at BillWhittle.com how much we enjoy your work, and certainly hope that God continues to bless it.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
All right. Goodbye.
So now we can go back to our normally
scheduled programming.
Yes, yes. And we'll get to our comment from last week, which is from Daryl. He says, I saw Adam's Apples after you recommended it, and it was a good little film. Since Turnabout is fair play, I'd like to direct your attention to Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. I saw that today as well, and I would give it 4 out of 5 stars. Don't pay attention to the professional reviews. It works as a Jane Austen film and a zombie action movie. Great cast, too. I suspect your family would enjoy it as much as I did. It hardly made any money, and that is a crying shame. That is an interesting recommendation. I did not expect that one. I have heard different things about that one, kind of rumblings in the Twitter sphere, of people saying it was actually a lot of fun. So I don't know. I like Pride and Prejudice, and I like
zombies.
Funny zombie stuff. I don't think I'd actually like a straight zombie movie. I've never seen one, but I really thought Shaun of the Dead was hilarious. So, and that was a zombie parody movie. Maybe the purists don't like the parodies, but maybe I just like funny stuff. But I did enjoy that.
What is the scariest movie you've ever seen?
Ooh, the scariest movie I've ever seen. Well, there was this Mary-Kate and Ashley video when I was about 5 that I thought was the creepiest thing. No, I don't know. I don't watch much scary stuff. I really don't.
And I can't handle it.
I'm a wimp. We were talking about watching Silence of the Lambs earlier tonight, and, you know, I think my little sister would probably do perfectly fine.
I'd need therapy.
Yeah, I would probably need therapy. I want to watch it sometime, like, around 1 o'clock in the day.
Yeah, there's this lag time. If you can get outside or deprogram.
Yeah, that's...
And get your mind... Because my mind will not let it go.
Yeah.
When I get into something like that, I mean, and it... It hasn't happened a long time because I kind of don't do it anymore. But back in the day, I could watch a movie or a suspenseful movie or something like that, and my mind would not let it go all night.
Yeah, yeah, I've got that problem somewhat, and I always forget how much a movie can crawl inside my head, and just in time to watch a new one. Like I watched Pan's Labyrinth, and I remember it better in retrospect than I think I would after watching it, because I really didn't like the gory bits of it. There was this really creepy Spanish captain, but it was very beautifully shot and everything, and you know. But I forgot that just how much it bothered me. So I was like, okay, I'm going to watch another one of Guillermo del Toro's movies, and I watched Crimson Peak, and I'm like, nope, that is not for me. I enjoyed it, but too much. It was too gross. And you forgot it apparently completely.
I saw part of it, and I thought it was just ridiculous. Well, not ridiculous. It's just not very meh.
Yeah, it was very gothic, and it was very, very aesthetically dramatic. It was beautiful. It was really beautiful. All the gothic details and all of it. There was like these butterflies that were creeping around, and they like blood oozing from the walls and things. That was very creepy and very, very atmospheric. But
we'll need to look that up. We'll have to watch that.
Yeah, that looks like fun. Especially, you know, I was looking at the cast, and the cast looks good, which is always a good sign. And I like, who was in it? Lily James, I think.
Is it supposed to be funny?
I don't know. I mean, come on. Mm-hmm. The name of the movie is Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. It's got to be pretty funny. Matt Smith is in it, too, and Matt Smith is, we're watching Doctor Who right now, and he plays the doctor that we're currently on, and he plays Mr. Collins in Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, which somehow I could really see him doing. He reminds me of Gussie Finknottle, too. He reminds my sister of Gussie Finknottle. He reminds me of Harold Lloyd. So he reminds me of a lot of historical geeks. But anyway, Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, that sounds interesting. I don't think we'll have time to watch it before I head off to school tomorrow. Well, tomorrow... It'll be tomorrow by the time this airs. We're going to have to figure out exactly what our planning for that is going to be. The Pilgrims Podcast must adapt. And we're not very good at adapting.
Yeah, we'll get there.
We'll get, yes, this technology thing. But, anyway, so...
We'll have to, might be on the road, or...
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yes, a long-distance version.
The cell phone version.
Yeah. Anyway, I had, you know, this was...
So I watched, just real quickly, I watched a few minutes tonight of Red State Update.
Oh, yeah?
You remember that?
Never heard of it.
Well, there's a couple guys. If you'll, I haven't watched it in several years because I forget why. I think I just kind of got a little bit disgusted with them. But there's these two guys. There's Jackie Broles and Dunlap. And they're sitting in front of an American flag. And it is, when they were on point and on message, they were about as funny as it could be on the political side of things. They were extremely funny. But I would be interested to know what Daryl thinks of those guys. I mean, I don't know if it's shtick or if it's, or I think most of it is. I'm, you watch this, you're going to say, oh yeah, all of that is. But there is some, there's a lot of thought behind it. They've put a lot of thought behind it. It's really funny stuff. Anyway, Red State Update. I'm not recommending it. I'm just saying it's out there.
Okay. We were saying earlier that, you know, the slate of questions for the first half of the hour were so Trump-heavy that we should probably try and pivot around and be a little bit more fair and balanced. Anyway, so we were going to chat a little bit about Hillary, the other side of the coin. Right. You know, and I don't talk as much about Hillary because I just assume that people know that I'm as never Hillary as I am never Trump. Because I wasn't exactly shy about what I thought about politics for, my entire teenage life. So I just kind of assume that, I guess. And I should probably, I think a lot of conservatives see never Trumpers as going over to the other side or selling out, which we don't really see ourselves as that, you know. So I guess it's good to emphasize that just because we have issues with Trump doesn't mean in any way that we wish to compromise on...
Oh, she's a loathsome individual.
Yeah, yeah. And but we wanted to talk about a little bit about that because from a generational standpoint, looking at the Clintons, it's completely different because I was born in 1995, so it's really... I missed out on the whole Clinton administration. I don't remember any of that. I don't have any of that baggage, really.
Yeah. My opinion is that he benefited just like, in many respects, the Obama administration is benefiting. I'll get to that in a minute. But anyway, the Clinton administration, in my opinion, benefited from the explosion of the internet and the dot-com business. Now, I agree that the bubble kind of burst there, but nonetheless, there was this huge economic engine that kind of took off in the 90s, and Bill Clinton rode that wave. Now, he also, I think he was, he knew he had to, you know, he was willing to work with Congress, and it's my impression, again, I don't like Clinton, I think he, you know, was a bad guy, but this, I think Hillary, you know, I remember when Clinton was running, I think he maybe made the statement that it was a two-for-one deal. Is it? It wasn't just Bill that you were getting. You were also getting this remarkable, you know, energetic, clairvoyant lawyer of a wife in Hillary, and she was going to be a first lady like no one had ever seen before, and she wasn't going to bake cookies while, you know, in the kitchen while he's off at work. And then, you know, when the rumors started coming around and accusations started to fly, you know, she immediately said, well, it's just part of a vast right-wing conspiracy. And, you know, I'm not going to use the word sad because I don't think it was sad. I think it was...
sinister?
Almost sinister, that because she doesn't really... She's just a loathsome individual and is power-hungry and is willing to compromise the country and the country's best interest for her own sake. You need to look no further than this whole server mess to see that. Is the servers in her own home, its sole purpose was to protect her interests, and she didn't give a whit about what might happen for the country and what what that might mean. And I was having lunch today with a friend of mine who's a, you know, basically a lifelong Democrat. And he's like, well, you don't know that, that information was compromised. And I was like, right. Tell yourself that. But if you don't think that server wasn't hit by the Russians and the Chinese and probably the Koreans and half a dozen other countries, you're crazy. And I just think she has had, I don't know when it started, if it was in Arkansas, quite probably, because I would like to know how many times she's been back to Arkansas since she left there. But she has, and I've heard, you know, she hasn't driven a car since like 1989 or whatever, some crazy thing. And she's truly a political operative. She's almost like a cyborg. I was listening to the Right Angle guys the other day, and they were talking about how that she's just kind of mechanical.
The other day that, she was talking, I think, to Chris Wallace. Was it Chris Wallace? And she, like, lied about something, and she said that she short-circuited on the truth, which pretty much, for me, confirms all the conspiracy theories, guys. She is a robot.
Yeah. She just, you know, I think her whole being is about power, being the first woman president. She really doesn't, I don't think she really, I think she thinks that her policies and liberal policies are best for the country. But what the real thing is about is just her getting in power.
Oh, I don't particularly think that she thinks they're the best. I don't think she's very ideologically motivated at all. Now, Obama, he's an ideologue.
Oh, yeah.
Obama very much so, but I don't think she is so much. I think that she's going to shift with the winds and, you know, do whatever she has to maintain power. Now, I just don't know whether she actually, there's any part of her that wants to help anybody. I don't think so. But, again, for me, you know, there's a lot, especially for a lot of people in my generation, I mean, they hear from their parents, from Republican parents, okay, Hillary Clinton is awful. And then they hear about the server and that sort of thing, but they don't have any of the 90s baggage. They don't have any of and because Clinton is so good at this whole mantra, this whole just the idea that you need to move on, let's move on. There was an article, I can't remember where it was the other day, that I read. It was talking about how every crisis that comes up, they start to just say, okay, well, that's yesterday's news. And just try and push it out of the public eye, which is interesting because apparently the Trump campaign's strategy is to do the exact opposite.
I would not be.
It's very effective.
I would not be surprised, and in fact, it may even be his goal. Is if Donald Trump goes into a debate with Hillary Clinton, that just before he goes on, his campaign manager says, "You got to make her leave in tears," and I think he might be able to do it. I really think he might punch her so hard, and she's got a glass jaw. I think he might go after her so hard that she's reduced to tears, and if she is on national TV. It would be, you know, hey, I ain't got a dog in that fight. Not my circus, not my monkeys. But it would be a moment of triumph for somebody.
Yeah, I remember watching
I think it's distinctly possible that could happen.
Yeah, the first debate, you know, a year ago, and it was just like, man, this is great stuff. What political theater? And I will give this election that anyway. It is something to watch. Things that you would never have thought happened.
Yeah.
I
think she, you know, you, the, but the, I was going to say the other, the Obama administration is riding, in my opinion, it's riding the wave of fracking. Fracking, which is, I mean, what I was paying almost $4 a gallon in gas a few years ago. And when I say a few years ago, I mean during the Bush administration. And now, I filled up for this morning like at $1.60 something a gallon, and that's because fracking and natural gas. I think, I mean, I'm no expert, but that is a huge deal. If by some miracle that Donald Trump were to pull it this off and, you know, call Hillary a little girl and she goes hobbling off the stage crying, and he wins the election, you can mark it down. Within 6 months, fracking would be the biggest evil in the world. That fracking would be, you know, the reason that the world's going to hell in a handbasket is because of fracking.
Oh, yeah.
But they're not going to do that while Obama's in power because there's too many, there's a, too much of a windfall economically that he can ride. While, you know, while the economy's okay, he can push through all this other liberal agenda crap, you know, and nobody cares because the economy's so great. Goes back to Clinton. When he had the deal with Monica Lewinsky, you know, nobody wanted to get impeach. You know, the public opinion was strongly against Clinton being impeached,
but
that was because the economy was so good.
The economy, yeah. Now, and this, I'm in almost entirely ignorant of most of these things, and I understand that Bill Clinton is. Seems to be slightly more conservative when it comes to the economy than Hillary. I don't know if that's true.
I think that's probably true.
Yeah.
I think that's probably true, or at least he's willing to compromise and to... that's my impression, that, you know, when Gingrich came through, there was Clinton was elected, there was 2 years of Republican... two years of a Democratic majority, and then, I think I've got my dates right, 1994, there was this... Gingrich becomes Speaker of the House. It was like the first Republican Speaker of the House in 40 years or something crazy. And there was this huge swing toward the conservatives in the Congress. And Clinton saw it. I mean, he saw the writing on the wall. If he was going to get anything done, if he was going to have to work with these people, our people, Gingrich. And we got the best people. You know, we're putting the best people on this. And so he did that, and we all benefited, you know, I guess. And I don't know, I think that's something Mr. Obama has been unwilling to do. That's my impression, that he has been unwilling to really compromise on any of his principles, even when he's working with a Republican Senate and House in order to try to get some things accomplished. But, yeah. And I don't think if Hillary wins, which is very likely, and that's another thing is that bugs me is everybody calls her Hillary, you know, like she's your grandma or your aunt, you know, that your goofy aunt that comes over at Christmas time, but she I remember when she was when Clinton was first elected. The very first thing she asked, or she basically said, from now on, the name's Hillary Rodham Clinton.
Yeah.
And that's been conveniently, you know, shuffled aside while she's running because with the Clinton name because it's more of a brand. But you can guarantee that if she wins, and she raises her hand, it'll be, do you Hillary Rodham Clinton? It will not be Hillary Clinton.
I really do think that for my generation especially, she's always talking about being a woman and, oh, you've got to get a woman elected. And I think that being a woman has freed her in some ways from a lot of the kind of stereotypes, from corruption because of stereotypes about women. I think she does benefit from that. I don't know if that's entirely true, but I think that she...
They're a business.
I mean, because when you look at her, if you're not a conservative, if you're kind of a more usual millennial, I guess you don't think power-hungry bureaucrat quite as easily as you should. And that's disturbing. I wish that people were as clear-minded about her as they are about Trump. Trump, he just kind of like lets it all hang out.
But the press cover.
And yeah, that's true. The press are insanely biased.
Well, they are. They are, yeah. And that shouldn't be news to the Trump people, you know. That's it's wearing a little bit thin about the whole, you know, the press is dishonest and the press is, well, yeah, you know, that's true. But remember, you were going to flip New York. You were going to flip California. You were going to make those competitive. And the reality is that Georgia's likely not competitive. So it shouldn't be news to anybody that the media is left-wing and in the tank for Hillary Clinton. But it is what it is. And she's benefited from it for many years and will continue to. But I don't think they'll give her the cover that they've given Barack Obama. There'll be a honeymoon period, but that, I think a lot of people on the left, they just don't like her. I mean, I think they just don't like her.
I think this whole thing with Bernie has really left a lot of...
The corporate, especially the corporate tie-ins. She is a corporate machine. I heard her complaining about, you know, Trump's economic team being made up of oil barons and, you know, all these you know, hedge fund managers and all this stuff. And I'm sitting here thinking, okay, who's yours? You know, what the history of your team is. Someone tells me it's not the guy that works down at 7-Eleven either.
Yeah, I mean, the contrast with Bernie, who had all those small donations, and you know, Hillary goes on all day long about Citizens United and how awful it is that people can donate money to criticize her, and how, you know, oh no, politicians being owned by the rich, and I'm like,
well, she's got. I mean, it's
look at the Clinton Foundation.
But you know, there was a time when I used to think that she would be so difficult to beat, and now the reality is, it's just, you know. Unfortunately, we have the single guy in, it seems like, all of America that's going to lose to her. Because anybody else would be pummeling her right now. They would really have her on the ropes. I believe that. I mean, I don't even want to think about it. What a Cruz or a Rubio would be doing with her right now.
Yeah, it's best not to think about it at this point. But anyway, we need to wrap up. This is our last pre-college episode. I'm about to go off and meet all the Hillary people.
Yes.
So yeah, the belly of the beast, pray for me, dear listeners, because it is going to be a fun, and by fun I mean not fun at all, experience going to college and then arguing with all the liberal people and then coming back and arguing with all the Trump people. So, you know.
So please have some mercy.
Yeah, it's, well, you know, and I can say this, though. I have pro-Trump friends. I have liberal friends. And it's, I just hope that we'll be able to make it out of this election safely.
Yeah. And I really think that we would all be well served to think about what happens next.
Because one of them's going to win.
Yeah.
And, you know, after that...
Yeah, whoever wins, there needs to be some unity, at least on our side of the fence, in my opinion.
Hmm.
And, because this has been brutal.
Yeah. Well, we had better wrap it up, and next time we don't really know what we'll be doing. We could be doing Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. I would love to do an episode on silent movies sometimes because I just had a piece published in the Weekly Standard, the online version, on silent movies, and I love to talk about them. So, listeners, you should go read that anyway because it was fun to write, and there are lots and lots of recommendations in it, and I love to recommend things to people.
And we're looking for our next guest.
I have a friend who is a blogger who wants to be on sometime.
So we're going to do that sometime soon.
Yeah. So, in the meantime,
we're going to do that at Thanksgiving.
We should.
Honor up,
yeah.
You know, long term.
Yes. So, ta-ta for now.
Thank you so much for listening, and we especially thank Scott Ott again for appearing on our little podcast.
And that's it.
All the money that e'er I had, I spent it in good company. and all the harm I've ever done. Alas, it was to none but me, and all I've done for want of wit to memory now I can't recall. So fill to me the parting glass, good night and joy be to you all. Sorry for